Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 2/28/2011. I have a home group. It's in Edmonds home group, Tuesday nights. Actually, in the summers, we have nice beachfront barbecues the last Tuesday of every month. So that's usually when we get a lot more attendance. I have a sponsor. I sponsor three young men currently. And I've got 15 minutes to tell my story, so I'm going to get right into it. It's actually the tougher one of the two, I think. Tough to get in 15 minutes, but I don't think I have a particularly interesting story, but that's not always the case with other folks. So you don't know what somebody's going to grasp on to or glean from your story. So I grew up in Edmonds, and I had an amazing childhood, adolescence. I had incredible parents. Alcohol was not really part of my household. Nobody in my immediate family had any problems with alcohol. I didn't even start drinking until I turned 17. And so that's, but from the moment I turned, roughly 17, I was in sports and things like that. So I didn't have the opportunity. But the first night I drank, I blacked out. I was the captain of the football team. I was the captain of the basketball team. And every time I went out and drank, every few 2-3 months when the opportunity arose, I blacked out or I threw up. And I didn't, you know, at the time, you obviously don't know what that's all about. And then fast forward, had the normal college. Well, not a normal college, but, you know, I went to Washington State and went in a fraternity. And I was just a walking stereotype. You know, I did everything that you watch on the movies. And I thought that was pretty normal, because most of the other young men around me were doing the same thing, but they were doing it with far less frequency. I just, you know, when you're living with 55 guys, you know, it only takes 15 of them maybe on a night, and you think that everybody's like you. That's not the case. A lot of those other young men are up studying and doing normal things. So my first inclination that I was an alcoholic probably occurred when I got out of school. I was 23, 24. I was starting to drink a half gallon by myself on a weekend. And I was depressed. I had some things going on in my life, but it really was the first time I was living in Scottsdale, Arizona by myself. And I was very unhappy. And I was drinking close to a half gallon by myself, starting Friday at 5 o'clock and going all through till Sunday night at midnight. That's not normal behavior from a 23-year-old, and my life was pretty good otherwise. So I'll just say that this program was very hard for me to get, because I usually got everything I wanted. I wouldn't say I was entitled, but things came easy to me, and this program was not one of them. And I did all the normal things. I mean, I was a highly, highly productive alcoholic in my 20s. And I was the guy who could go run 4 or 5 miles, then start drinking a case of beer on a Saturday morning, and then go mow the lawn, clean my house, and the whole time drinking cases of beer, right? And nothing ever bad happened to me. Then I, you know, made the mistake of getting married, and somebody else told me I was had a problem, right? That was a big eye opener. And obviously, my wife at the time, tried to manage my drinking, and that was tough, really tough, because I was doing well. I'm not gonna lie, I was in my late 20s, I was making very good money. I had 1.3 kids, and, you know, 2 cars, and living on Capitol Hill. I was doing well, but that's when the crazy stuff started happening as far as hiding your drinking. That's when things became very exhausting. And I was working downtown, and I had 2 children, and I had 3 people totally dependent on me for income. So I had some infrastructure there that I couldn't really just check out and go to Costa Rica and drink for a month. which is, you know, what I wanted to do. But there were a lot of mornings when I was the guy who, you know, got into the hobby of drinking wine, because that's not unique to me, but it's a passing hobby that was just another reason for me to drink, right? And I had a wine closet, and nothing ever matured past 2 or 3 days. But I had a wife at the time who didn't really drink, so she didn't know what was down there. She just knew it cost money, and I was making money, so I guess that was okay. And there were many times where I would, you know, I was going in downtown to work at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, hungover as hell. I'd have a bag of empty bottles with me, and I was probably 2, 3 mornings a week parking in the garage downtown, you know, those underground parking garages, and cling, 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 you know, emptying my bag of bottles every morning and doing this to make sure that I was leading a double life. I really was. Nobody had any idea, and it was exhausting. It was really hard. I had so many balls in the air. And, you know, 3 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 11 o'clock, I was thinking about when I was very analytical in my drinking, so I knew at what point I needed to start drinking, and how many beers I was needed to have, and at what time I needed to stop, because I had to get home, and I had to give off the perception that I wasn't, you know, in the bag, and then be a dad and try to be a husband and you know, try to cook and do things at home. So it was all orchestrated very much. It was exhausting. And there's a lot of funny, you know, I would have the kids in the car and we'd all, the family would be going somewhere. And I was the guy that had to pre-funk, because now it was becoming such a problem that we all knew the elephant was no longer, you know, the elephant was in the room and I knew I had a problem, but I was doing everything I could to get around it. And that included pre-funking before we went out. And so that was, a lot of times we would all get in the car and I'd be like, shoot, I forgot something. I got to go back in the house. And I would run downstairs, run into my wine closet. I had one of those butterfly wine openers that are like, shoo, shoo, you know, one of those fast ones. And it sounds like that. And and I would run into my wine closet and I would shoo, shoo. And I would drink a bottle of Cabernet in probably about 6.3 seconds. And I could just, you know, I had that open gullet thing and I could do it. And then, you know, put it away, run up, get in the car. Okay, let's go. You know, and, you know, my kids are in the back and, yeah, I had a lot of those things going on. I had there was a lot of periods of trying to get dry in sobriety. I tried doing the near beer, the one, whatever it's called, O'Doul's. I tried doing that for a while, and that appeased my wife at the time and everybody around me. Oh, yeah, I'm not. But I was drinking Mirapons. I was pouring Mirapons into my O'Doul's out in my garage, and I'm not handy, but I was always spending a lot of time in the garage. Building and making stuff, and I can't make anything. But what I was doing, obviously, is pouring out the O'Doul's, pouring the Mirapon in, and nobody could understand why I was in the bag, you know, on most nights drinking O'Doul's. So I was doing that. I had some other pretty emotional or sad things happen to me while I was trying to get sober. You know, I came home totally drunk one night to see my wife at the time miscarrying our twins. That was a tough one. I made amends for that one. That was a tough one. Where was I going? So the biggest part, the reason I my story's a little different in that, I had it all. I was doing well. I was a highly productive drunk until I wasn't. Right? And that's the commonality that we all have, right? We all fall apart at the end. It just depends on, you know, our paths are a little bit different, but we all fall apart. And I fell apart, and I couldn't accept it. I couldn't accept my alcoholism. And so I was the guy, there's a few familiar faces in these rooms going back to the early 2000s when I was first trying to get sober. And those guys I didn't like. I didn't like those guys in here. I was the guy sitting in the back of the room. I was the last guy in. I come in, you know, right about now, and I was the first guy to leave, and I never took service. I never talked to anybody. And And that was hard. So I was living, I was in a rock, between a rock and a hard place. You know, I knew I wasn't, I couldn't drink out there anymore. And I hated coming in here. I hated it. I hated being maybe an alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic, but I hated being an alcoholic. So that went on for a long time. For a few years, I got some periods of sobriety and then, you know, being dry. Went through the steps a few times, probably three times. First couple times, I just treated it like a project. I'm very project-oriented in my work, and going through the steps with my sponsor was just like going through another project at work. And I'm a poster boy for getting stuff done. And I'm an overachiever, and I get through the steps, but nothing was coming inside. Nothing was going on in here. And I was really unhappy in my family life. But mostly that's because of me. I really disliked myself. And that's part of acceptance, right? After a period of 3.5 years, and this is like 2008, I thought it was a good idea to start drinking again. And I can remember the first day I drank, I was sitting underneath the deck of my home. I just built a home, up in Sandpoint. And I was doing work on the outside, and I decided to go get a six pack of Mirror Pond and sit underneath my deck, hidden from my family while I could start. That's how I broke out the last time. And then it took me a while to come back in. I had one occasion where, I worked for a large, timber real estate company in Seattle, and I was doing quite well there, and I was sober. And then I started drinking again, as I mentioned. And literally 2 weeks later, the recession was going on, and our company was laying off everybody, and I lost my job. And I just built a home. My marriage was crumbling, and I decided to play out a movie scene and go drink all day at every bar I wanted to drink at the last 3.5 years that I hadn't. And I came home completely inebriated and had a physical altercation with my wife at the time in front of my three young children. And that was, that's probably my low point right there. I lost my wife, my children, my house, my career, all in one day, that one day. So there's my bottom. There's my bottom, right? It unraveled completely. And so the solution, what happened with me is I finally took a time out from my life. And I went to treatment. I'm just a little bit, I don't recommend that for everyone. A lot of people can come into AA and get sober and never look back. I was a multiple, I can't think of the word, but I went back out a lot. And I needed to go to treatment, so I went to Hazleton for 60 days. And I came back and I relapsed again. That was the word I was looking for, relapse. I relapsed again. I was the poster boy for treatment and did everything they asked of me and came back out, and I relapsed one more time. I even orchestrated it. I planned it all out and knew how I was going to do it. And then that was it. That's what I needed. And that relapse made me look at my program. It made me look at my sponsor. It made me look at my service and my commitment to the program, and I changed everything. And so that was almost 5 years, 4.5 years ago. And from that point on, I got home groups. From that point on, and I say multiple home groups, plural, because I needed a Tuesday and a Friday. I needed service. And so I went to those business meetings as much as I disliked it. And as much as you couldn't really see on the outside how much I was hurting. But on the inside, I was really faking it till you make it. I was struggling really hard to let you in. Side this and learn to maybe like me. And so I started doing that. I started signing up for service positions. I started making coffee. I started secretarying a meeting. All things that were foreign to me, all things that were not intuitive. I didn't want to participate in this program. But I did, and it worked. It does work. It does. It just, you start getting fellowship. I needed that fellowship. I needed to have other men that I could count on as friends, because I didn't have any friends. I had zero friends. For my whole 20s and my 30s, I had no friends. It was alcohol and work and my family a little bit. And I started the service. I started gaining some momentum in my program. I found a sponsor. I went through the steps again. I started sponsoring other young men, which was a huge change for me and a huge challenge. And that worked, because once I went through the steps, I needed some different building blocks for my program. Sponsorship. fellowship and service is what saved me in this program. And now, you know, things are well. I have first world problems. You know, this tonight I got my car broken into at the Mariners game on Father's Day. Kind of like somebody crapped in the turd, you know, left a turd in the punch bowl. It's kind of like, had a great day, and then I walk up to my, but you know what? This program allows me to just like, you know, that's all right. You know, that's okay. I'm gonna move forward. Things seem to wash over me much, much easier. And, so I hope somebody could get something out of that 15 minutes. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. My name is Janae, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to participate in my own sobriety tonight. It's always a privilege to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to thank our first speaker. My sobriety date is May the 21st, 2008. I have a sponsor, she has a sponsor, and I'm fortunate enough to sponsor some women in this program. I also have a home group, that's Empire Way. We meet Mondays and Wednesdays at 8 o'clock, and we'd be very happy if you come by. So, I grew up without any alcohol around me at all. My family, I'm actually originally from the South. My family was very, very, very religious. And when I emphasize very, very religious, my grandfather was a fundamentalist preacher. So I never saw an adult drunk, as far as I know, my entire growing up. They didn't smoke, they didn't curse, they didn't engage in premarital sex, they didn't do any of those things, they just sat around judging people who did. So when I was 15, for a lot of reasons, I decided I was going to do every one of those things with as many people as often as I could, and if they found out about it, well, that was just too bad. Because I didn't like them, I didn't like their God, I was very unhappy, very angry, and in that context, I met alcohol, and I was fantastic at drinking, if I say so myself, fantastic. Even right now, standing here in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing every single thing that was to happen to me later, my alcoholic brain tells me that I was the best person at drinking of all time, and that I could probably do it again. And that's important. It's important for me to know that. That's why I pay attention to my alcoholic GPS. That's why I know where my next meeting is. That's why I know who my sponsor is and what step I'm working on. That's why I make sure that I pay attention to my sponsees. That's why I have a service position in my home group, because those things help me stay in the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. When my big old alcoholic brain, who I call Bob, decides to speak to me, I just ignore that guy, because he does not have my best interest at heart. You know, I kind of suspect my brain knows that I was trying to kill it for years, and now it's out to return the favor. So I started drinking at 15. I was a whiskey, gin, vodka, akvit, peach, schnapps, NyQuil, vanilla drinker. You may laugh about the vanilla, but let me tell you, 3 o'clock in the morning when you can't get anything, maybe that'll help you reach oblivion. And that was the way I drank. That was the way I drank from the very beginning. I was fantastic. I was fantastic at it. I could drink men under the table, and I was very proud of that fact. At the end of the night, there'd be maybe one football player. Sometimes that girl, you know that girl. Sometimes I was that girl. Sometimes I was trying to sleep with that girl. Didn't matter. The football player was happy. All worked out. And that's the way I remember that period. The whole thing is covered with this kind of golden glow. Except when I worked on my first step, I realized that it wasn't actually that fantastic, because I first began trying to quit drinking when I was 19. I tried twice more in my 20s, twice more in my 30s, and once more in my early 40s. By my early 40s, there was no illusion whatsoever about whether or not my drinking was fun. I would get up in the morning. I don't know why I thought this would make any impression or difference, but I would look myself in the mirror, and I would beg. Not pretty reasoning, beg. I would beg myself to stop. I would go through the list of everything that I was about to lose, the people that I might kill, myself, everything I could think of. Please, please, not today, not today. You can make it till 10. You can make it till 10. Get home. All that begging never worked. And there was no question for me that I could stop. mean, I was a reasonably smart, somewhat capable person. I had given it my best effort. And my very best effort, backed by all of my will and some intelligence, had done nothing. So it was clear. I was just an alcoholic. And the question was how I could manage it, how I could manage the symptoms. So I cut my drinking kit down to a credit card, one house key, and my driver's license. That way, maybe I wouldn't drive drunk. Maybe I could avoid killing somebody. I believe I did, but I can't actually tell you that I did. I don't know, because that's the way my drinking was. It just took me. Now, I've told you a little bit about what alcohol was doing for me. I have to tell you a little bit about what I brought to alcohol. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I refer to it with a shorthand, the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good, as you've already understood, is my family. They were very, very good. And I was bad. I was bad in a lot of ways. I was bad in some very special and particular ways. Some of these ways I didn't really understand. When I was a little girl, my female relatives started taking me aside and explaining to me there were things girls liked and things they didn't like and things God didn't like little girls to like. And that I had better get my act together and stop liking whatever it was that I liked that I wasn't supposed to, because that was something terrible and horrible and awful. They never said what the terrible, horrible, awful thing was, but I figured out pretty quickly it meant I should never talk to them about myself again. So I stopped. I split my life. And I went around, and I lived that way, and I was very good at keeping secrets. I already had quite a few secrets by the age of 10. That's the part that's the ugly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time about that, but I will tell you this. The first time my skull was fractured, I was 8 months old. The second time, I was not yet 4. By the time I was 15, I'd had as many concussions as I'd had birthdays, and I had been beaten, whipped, cut, and burned at the hands and with the knowledge of this family who was so religious. So I hated God. God never helped me, and I hated people that I believed in God. And that was the whole reason why, if I want to take a drink, hey, it's all mine. That's all for me. And you can't do a thing about it. It's probably not too surprising that I couldn't get sober. So the last night of my drinking ended at about 9:20. As far as I know, I assume that's when it's ended, because that's when my watch shattered. I believe I was thrown out of the back of the cab at that point, and it took me about 3 hours to figure out that I wasn't going to be able to walk to my front door. And in the meantime, I managed to struggle to my feet and fall face first repeatedly. By the time I did make it to my front door, I looked pretty much like somebody had beaten me with a baseball bat. You know, there's a passage in the Daily Reflections that I really like, and it says essentially, everything I feared happened to me because of my drinking. All those things that I was drinking to avoid, I brought on myself. Every single thing that I wanted to forget and not acknowledge, I did. So, next day, of course, I can't keep anything down. It wasn't even a remarkable drunk, really, for me. But everybody was angry. All of my efforts to get sober previously had involved things I couldn't hide. You know, I didn't really ever have any incentive to try to get sober unless other people had caught me in my drinking. And then my sobriety efforts were all just to avoid the consequences of the terrible things that I had done. So the next day, I can't deny this stuff. I'm in real trouble with my partner at the time. I'm in real trouble with my business partner. And I had my first spiritual experience. Now, I didn't see it as a spiritual experience until several years later. But I said, please. I didn't know what or to whom I was saying please. I just said please, and I meant it with all my heart. And if I were actually a spiritually oriented person, perhaps the pink pony of sobriety would have come to me, and there would have been sparkles and a white light, and everything would have been good, and I would have then immediately recognized my sobriety. But that is not what happened. What happened is that Bob started talking to me, my big old alcoholic brain. And it said, what do you do when you're in trouble? You go to AA to show people that you mean to be better next time. I had no intention of going to AA. No way. But I'm also a really good liar. And I know you can't tell a lie if you don't know anything at all about the subject. I would never have guessed there was a thing called a big book. And I knew so little about AA, I didn't even suspect people were going to say God to me ever at all. And I was such an incredible alcoholic, I was actually in 3 or 4 meetings before I even realized that word was in use. So I drag myself off to my first meeting. It's mainly men, because I was far too full of myself and capable and competent to ask anybody for anything about this. I went on the internet, I found the next meeting, I went there. I don't think it was a men's meeting. Maybe, I'm not sure. The counselor at that meeting is the first person who saved my life. He gave me the abbreviated first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I've never trusted people, but I've always trusted what I could read in a book, I read it. And that's why you have me as a speaker tonight instead of somebody else. So he also told me to go to a women's meeting the next day. I don't know why I did, probably because I was reading the big book. I got in there and I almost ran out. And a woman saw me and she sat next to me. And then she took me to the newcomers meeting that was held in the back. And that woman saved my life. And that's why I'm your speaker tonight, because she kept me in that room. And at the end of that meeting, another woman bought me my first big book. And that woman saved my life. And that's why I'm here tonight. I started going to meetings. No intention of going to meetings. At that point, I was absolutely convinced I didn't really need to. I mean, obviously, it's all just a bunch of hand-holding and yah, 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 and rah, rah, rah. And I was fairly arrogant and nasty. And my opinion was, frankly, if I need therapy, I will pay someone a lot of money for it. Thank you. But Alcoholics Anonymous is not therapy, as I discovered. So I started going to this meeting. I was a fairly nasty kind of newcomer. Not at all pleasant. I was very fond of telling people that I thought they were stupid and that I, by contrast, was very smart. Since I was shaking and they all kept coming up to me and telling me that I probably ought to go to treatment and I was refusing to do that, you can judge just how accurate I was about my assessment. There was a woman in one of these meetings that I went to very regularly who didn't try to confront me. She didn't give me a hard time at all. She would just come stand by me, ask me how I was. She knew my name. That woman saved my life. And that's why I'm one of your speakers tonight, because of her. And if I sound broken up and touched about this stuff, please understand, I wasn't into crying at all before I got here. But the fact is that I am so overwhelmingly amazed at the power of this program, because it turns out that even if I don't want it to, even if I don't care, even if I'm convinced of all the reasons why I am too smart and too unique, it still works. If I will take actions that I don't understand and don't like, this program works. Because if you're an alcoholic of my type, the problem isn't so much the drinking. It's what happens in my head when I stop. I have to drink. It's the only thing that makes life tolerable. I have to have some solution to that intolerable condition of living and breathing and walking and dealing with people and not getting what I want. And it used to be that what I did was get a car or the thing or the job or the education. I moved across country. I mean, my problem was that I was in Texas. My problem was that I was unique and special and fantastic, and you can never understand my pain. That was my problem. And if I still have those problems and I'm still walking around with that stuff, sobriety, physical sobriety without anything else is awful. It's awful. I can't do that. I have to have a solution to that. And that is what this program offered me. Only I wasn't smart enough to pick it up right at first. So I got a sponsor. And that woman is why I'm here tonight. I went up to this woman. She hadn't been raising her hand, so of course that meant she was a challenge. I thought she should realize and appreciate the offer that I was giving her. Here I am. I had stopped shaking by this point. I am pretty confident that I was no longer yellow, and I could keep solid food down. This is all great progress. So I said, hey, you know, I'm willing to be your sponsee. pretty nifty offer, don't you think? And she said, we'll see. The woman interviewed me. She asked me what I was willing to do to get sober. She asked me if I was willing to do things that I didn't agree with. I wasn't going to do that. But I said yes, because it's always easier to say yes. At least that's what I thought. But the crazy thing is that I started doing what she told me to do. I wanted what she had, which was the actual joy of living. And she began teaching me that physical abstinence was not the same thing as sobriety, and that there are these nifty things called steps, and that if I would actually follow them in order, they would allow me to deal with my insane and unmanageable life. They would allow me not to need to be unconscious to be around other people. And that was an incredible offer. So she insisted that I take a service position. She asked me to be the greeter for our meeting. Now, I didn't like to touch people. I didn't like to talk to people. I was a lot smarter than virtually anyone I knew there, and I didn't want to know their names, hold their hands, or say anything to them. And I was the new greeter for the meeting. She let me do it my way for two meetings. Supervised, by the way, by one of her friends with long-term sobriety. I was, I think, quite possibly the nastiest, most cynical, obnoxious greeter of all time. And she let me do that as long as I was greeting people with long-term sobriety. And her friend cut me off anytime we saw anybody who looked remotely new. And after she had let me do it twice my way, she asked me how I would feel if someone had spoken to me the way I was talking to the people who were coming to the meeting. And she suggested that if I wanted to continue to be her sponsee, I would welcome people as openly as I could and to the best of my ability. And I started doing that. And over time, I got to know every single woman at that meeting. And I cannot go back to that meeting without having a rush of warmth and love for those women who helped me get sober. And if those women hadn't put up with my nastiness for as long as they did, until I got better, you'd have a different speaker. But they did, and I did do what she told me to do. Now, the God thing struck me as a virtual impossibility. I just didn't see how we were going to get around that. But she told me that I could have any higher power I wanted as long as it wasn't Bob. So I picked physics. Because that seems smart to me, right? I'm supposed to be so damn smart. Physics, gravity. I know if I step off the roof of a building, I'm going to fall at a fixed rate. That is definitely bigger than me. Has nothing to do with God. I can sound kind of scientific and smarty pants when I talk about it. And that's my higher power. Thank you very much. It turns out that's enough. It turns out that for me was enough. Because about 5 months into my sobriety, I had my second spiritual experience. And that experience was very simple. We were reading, and this was a big book study. It was my home group at that time. And we were reading this story out of the back of the book, because at this particular meeting, they read every page, every word of every page of the big book. We were reading a story out of the back, and it involved a woman who had reached out and found a spiritual life. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if that could actually be true? Wouldn't that be nice to not always have to be the one? Wouldn't it be nice if I could just let go of some of this stuff that I am managing and holding on to all of the time? And that, it turns out, was enough to open my spiritual experience. That, it turns out, was just enough for me to open the idea that maybe I didn't have to spend all my time fighting with God. So when it came to turning over my will and my life, my sponsor emphasized to me that the important thing was primarily that I was willing to do that, and that I continue to work on that, and that I continue to work on some spiritual growth. Fourth step, that's no problem. I figured she was going to be shocked, but, you know, hey, she'd ask for it. So I was going to tell her every nasty, horrible thing I could think of. And I did. Unfortunately, she was not very shocked. But she also told me I was not complete. See, I had discovered a long time ago that it's better to be angry than afraid. Anger is powerful. Anger is strong. Fear, I didn't like fear at all. And I had made a conscious decision when I was about 10 that I would never be afraid again. Never. I was never going to cry. I was never going to be afraid. And I don't care how much you hit me, I will not back down. Ever. And I will never pray. Ever. So she explained to me that I had to have fear on my inventory. And I told her that I didn't consider that to be any kind of an issue. I don't understand what the problem is. I don't have any fears. And just as I hadn't really had any resentments, because I didn't resent people, I got even. She explained that was not acceptable. I had to do it again. So I managed to admit that perhaps I might be a little afraid of snakes. It's a phobia. People have it. It's irrational. And then I acknowledged that I might be afraid that other people would discover I wasn't as tough and as competent as I wanted to be. And then I admitted that I was really afraid all the time of everything. That really, I was afraid that everything that had happened to me I had deserved. That really, I was afraid that I was worthless and broken. That really, I was so afraid that if you knew who I was, I would be cast out and never ever allowed in company with anyone. That's really what I was afraid of. And she said, that's a good beginning. Now we're going to turn that over to God. And I balked. I wish I could tell you that I went through every single one of the steps and that I had been entirely spiritual, but I got terrified. I became afraid that if I turned over all of those character defects and all of those bad qualities, then there would be nothing of me left. How am I going to fight? How am I going to exist? How am I going to be if I'm not these bad things? She said, okay, that's fine. Let's go back to step 3. And we just worked on it. We kept working on it until we got to the 8th and 9th step. And at that point, I knew enough to be a little concerned about doing the 8th and 9th step. See, I hadn't been very concerned about that when I first got into the program and I saw that, because I was the kind of person who could apologize to you and you would feel sorry for me, and I would get something out of it at the end of the whole exchange. You know, I'm really so incredibly sorry, and I'll never do it again. And by the way, is that your car over there? Because I need a ride. And that was the way I operated. I didn't understand that making amends was not the same thing as making an apology, and that I didn't get to talk about the other person at all, and that I had to be really as honest with them as I had been with myself about these character defects, in some respects, to the extent that I wouldn't harm them. But I also found out from her that if I was honest in talking about what I had done, there really wasn't much room to talk about what they had done either, which was very helpful. And at about this time, she made me do something that I absolutely did not want to do. She made me go on a spiritual retreat. Now, I don't like going to places I don't know and sleeping with strangers. Well, at least not in the context of a spiritual retreat, to be clear. But she said I was going to go. And the food was awful. The accommodations were terrible. I didn't like anything I heard for days. And I had my third spiritual experience there. Because at that retreat, for whatever reason, something, maybe the fact that I had done it when I didn't want to, with every fiber of my being, I didn't want to, maybe because I had been listening to her and becoming more honest with myself, I was able to be honest about the fact that I hated God and why I hated God. And in admitting that and addressing that, I was able to finally let go of that resentment. And you know, it kind of makes sense. Because when I was at my lowest, when I had absolutely nothing to offer anyone, when I was mean and nasty and covered in my own vomit and blood, frankly, I had prayed that one please, and I had gotten help. Now, I still don't have the kind of mind that is willing to go too far in areas that I don't understand. It's hard for me. But I have absolute confidence and faith in this program. And I have absolute confidence and faith that if I ask for help, help comes. And I don't know if I'm talking to another part of my brain that Bob doesn't live in or what. And I don't care. What I care about is the effect. What I care about is that I'm happy and joyous and free. What I care about is that sobriety, genuine sobriety, spiritual, emotional, and physical, is the best life I have ever had. And it's a life that I never, ever imagined was possible for me. I was absolutely convinced. My psychiatrists, the psychologists, all of those people who had diagnosed me with a host of issues and problems, including complex PTSD and anxiety and all of this stuff, and who had said to me, you know, it's just really remarkable you haven't killed somebody yet. I'm like, well, thank you. Thank you. Ringing endorsement. Thank you. It turns out that if I take some simple steps and incorporate them into my life, and I begin through those steps to develop a spiritual way of living, I have a life that so far exceeds my expectations, that is so much better than anything I could ever have imagined, that I wouldn't trade it for anything. I genuinely believe the very worst thing that had ever happened to me in my life, worse than a whole host of pretty bad things that had happened to me up to that point, I genuinely thought the worst thing that ever happened in my life was when I had to admit that I was an alcoholic to somebody else. Best thing that ever happened to me, because it's the foundation for everything that's come since. It is the foundation now of my daily living. And I have found a joy and a pleasure in living that I just honestly didn't even know I could. And I found a fellowship of remarkable people. I am now in contact with these wonderful, wonderful people in this fellowship. I have good friends. I have a dear sponsor. I have a wonderful wife, all of whom came to me through this program and through the context of dealing with people honestly through these steps. That would not have been possible for me before. The things I want are totally different than the things I used to believe were important. I don't care what car you drive. That doesn't matter. I care about the person in the car now. I never cared about that before. I don't care as much about what car I drive. That never happened. And now it seems I kind of care about the person in my car. I didn't think that was possible for me. And all of it has happened as a result of this program. And all of it has happened as a result of people reaching their hand out and being involved in service. You know, my sponsor emphasized service to me at the very outset. She said one of the requirements, as a matter of fact, of being her sponsee was to have a service position. I had to go to a set number of meetings a week. One of them had to be a step study, and one of them had to be a big book study. I was allowed to have some discussion studies after that, or some general discussion meetings as well. I had to have 4 or 5 in the beginning. I still maintain a good number of meetings every week. I also had to have a service position. I had to have a service position in every single meeting that I attended with any regularity. And I am so incredibly grateful. I was the world's worst coffee maker. Truly. Truly. Because I stressed about it a lot. I decided that I would go out and buy special beans that I would grind at home so that everyone would know that my coffee was the best coffee. People were going to seek out that coffee. And it didn't go that way at all. And nobody liked my special coffee that I thought was really good. I had to change that. She said, you make the coffee that's here. You make it the way that we make it. You're like everybody else. Just do what I ask you to do. I've had the opportunity to be involved in general service, to participate in the way that AA makes sure that the meetings are known and that, you know, the lights are on, and to participate kind of in the activities that allow me to know that if other members of my family need a meeting, if other friends, if other folks need a meeting, that meeting can be there for them, just like that meeting was there for me. Because it's vitally important that that meeting is there. And I am responsible for that. I have gotten this gift, and now my responsibility is to try and be like that first man who gave me the abbreviated portion of the Big Book, like that first woman who sat with me and didn't let me run out of the room when I tried to, like the woman who came and stood beside me and kept me coming to the meetings, even though she didn't do anything except know my name and put up with my nonsense. It's my job to be that hand of AA, and I'm incredibly grateful that I have the opportunity to continue to do that, even in a small way. So I keep track of my sobriety GPS because my sponsor told me in the very beginning, because I wanted to drink every second of every day for months in this program, every second of every day, and I kept thinking, when is this going to stop? And she kept saying, do the work, and it'll get better. And it did. Eventually, it went away. That was incredible to me. That day that it went away, that I realized that I had gone a day and hadn't thought about drinking, that was incredible. I keep track of my GPS because at the time when it was like that for me, she told me, if I always knew what step I was working on, if I always knew where my next meeting was, if I always knew who my sponsor was and what my service position was, if I knew those things, I could have a happy, joyous sobriety. And I am happy to say that it has been. Bad things have happened to me in sobriety. Nothing compared to the joy of sobriety. So if you're new to this program, find a sponsor. Find that sponsor tonight. Get involved in your home group. Get a home group if you don't have one. Action is really genuinely, in my experience, one of the greatest things that we have available to us here. And there's a fantastic fellowship of people. Maybe I'm not like you. Maybe you don't relate to anything that I've said, but I guarantee you there's somebody in this room who is like you. And if not this room, in one of the 1,400 other meetings that we talked about tonight. And any one of us will not only tell you about our experience of sobriety, we'll take you by the hand and we'll show you exactly how we did it. Because that's the purpose of this program. There's no secrets. Just like the Big Book says, we're here to tell you how we did it and to help you do it too. Thank you all so much for my sobriety.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.